Welcome to another episode of Elaine's Literary Salon podcast. I'm your host, Jeffrey James Higgins. My wife, Cynthia, and I own Elaine's Restaurant and Elaine's Literary Salon. We've turned it into a hub for both readers and writers in the Washington, D.C. area. And to date, I believe I've interviewed 178 authors. I'm really excited today to have J.D. Barker with us. J.D.'s not just a super talented writer, but he's also one of the most innovative and courageous people I've seen in the business side of writing. He's done some really cool marketing things, which I'm sure we'll get to today. J.D. Barker is a New York Times and international best-selling author of numerous novels, including Something I Keep Upstairs and the wildly popular 4MK thriller series. He regularly collaborates with James Patterson. His books have been translated into 24 languages, sold in more than 150 countries, and optioned for both film and television. Barker resides in coastal New Hampshire with his wife, Dana, and their daughter, Ember. And I should also add, J.D., to your intro there, that you're the host of the Writers, Inc. podcast, which is by far my favorite podcast. I listen to that religiously every week, and I've been on it once, so I'm thrilled to have you on our show. So, J.D., welcome to Elaine's Literary Salon.
Hey, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Oh, it's my pleasure. So you have the first Scarlet Door coming out later this year. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, so my 4MK trilogy has been out for, believe it or not, it's almost a decade now. I think Fourth Monkey came out in 2017. And it's one of those series, you know, like we haven't put any marketing dollars behind it, nothing like that for years. It was traditionally published, you know, so they get their little sales blip at the beginning and then things tend to go off to the back catalog and die. This book refuses to die. It seems to be getting bigger and bigger. It's still hitting bestseller lists, you know, 10 years later, still coming out in new countries. And it's one of those things where, you know, I travel around the world and people put it down in front of me and they're like, they just want to know more. And when I originally wrote this, like I originally just sold The Fourth Monkey. It was the first book in the series. It was supposed to be a standalone serial killer novel. I didn't have any expectations of continuing it. My agent started to shop it and she got a lot of interest. We ended up getting a film and TV deal. The book itself went to auction. And when that process was going on, she called me up and she's like, hey, do you have an idea for another book in the series? Because I think I can sell more than one of these. So I quickly scribbled out a way to keep the storyline going, and I ended up writing that. I just kind of fell in love with those characters. It turned into a trilogy, but I thought that I told the whole story. To give you the Cliff Notes version, when I decided to write a serial killer novel, I wanted to do something different from everybody else. That's kind of my motif. So in the beginning of this book, we've got a serial killer that's been running around Chicago for 5 years, terrorizing the city. Everybody knows who he is. Whenever he kidnaps a victim, he chops off that victim's ear, puts it in a little white box tied with a black string, and mails it to the victim's family, and things get horribly worse after that. So at the beginning of this book, we've got a guy who's crossing the street in Chicago, heading over to a mailbox with a little white box tied with a black string, and he gets hit by a city bus and killed. So the police quickly realize they've got, you know, the serial killer is dead. They also know the serial killer had another victim out there somewhere because he's got this box and there's something inside it, but they have no idea who he is or who the victim is, and that's where the ticking clock kind of comes into play, because every thriller needs a ticking clock. So that victim is out there somewhere, you know, with nobody giving her food or water, so they have to find her. But I knew in writing this book, I had to keep this serial killer alive somehow. So I put a diary on the body that they find that basically flashes back to the serial killer's, you know, childhood and the things that sort of shaped him into becoming a serial killer. And it's funny because initially when we took this book out, agents and editors all wanted me to take these diary entries out. They're like, just take them out, sell it as a straight up police procedural. That's how it's going to do best. And, you know, now we're 10 years later. If you go back and read the reviews, everybody loves the diary entries. That's like their favorite part. But they only give these little glimpses of the killer. You know, we flash back to this year, then to that year, we get little glimpses of what, you know, why he became who he was, but not the full story. So when COVID hit, you know, I'm at home locked in my house like everybody else. I sat down and decided, okay, I'm going to write 3 prequels to the series and tell his story in detail from start to finish. I didn't tell anybody I was working on these. I didn't tell my agents or my editors. I just wanted to see if I could write it and if I would actually like it. And it was honestly, it was so refreshing to write something like that, you know, for like the years leading up to it. You know, it's like I've had book after book after book, and, you know, like you kind of fall on this, you know, this gerbil wheel, and like it's tough to step off. So it was nice to just do something completely quiet. And as a writer, it was fun too, because if I wrote something, let's say in the third book that impacted the first or second, I could still go back and make changes, you know, because nobody had seen any of them yet. So it allowed me to create a really tight storyline that takes literally the whole thing and flips it on its head again. So that very long story to basically say the first book of that series is coming out in September. It's called The Scarlet Door. It's the book behind me here.
Oh my God, there's so much to that. So congratulations. I got to ask you, when you have agents and editors telling you, oh, cut the diary entries, you get this a lot, right? When you get input and people want certain things cut. How do you know as a writer when to stick to your guns and say, like, no, this is the art and this is what makes it special for me?
You know, it's a tricky thing because you don't want to be the guy standing on the soapbox saying, no, I'm not touching anything. This is it. You have to take that feedback with a grain of salt. I use a lot of beta readers. And if my beta readers, if multiple ones come back to me with the same problem, then I know I've got something I need to address. But if it's just one person out of the group, you know, for the most part, it's just an opinion. You know, to me, an agent's opinion is valuable, but it's one person's opinion. Same thing with an editor. So you kind of have to go with your gut. I tend to do everything a little bit different. So like there was a scene with rats, and I don't want to give it away in The Fourth Monkey, but it's a very graphic, you know, freaky, nasty scene. Editor immediately called me up and he's like, this is crazy. I love it, but it has to come out. It's too much. And I stood my ground on that one. I had him keep it in there. And again, that's one of those scenes people, you know, they email me about. It sticks with you. That's where people, you know, they close the book. For better or worse, it gives them an emotional reaction. And that's what you want to get out of your readers. Again, it's an opinion. So to give you another example, I had an editor who called me, I think I was on the Caller's Game, it was like 4 or 5 books into my career. And he said, okay, we just got some stats and it looks like your readership is primarily women 45 and over. So he said, we need you to write to that audience. That's your target audience. So instead I turned around and I wrote a young adult book. Because my thinking was, you know, I've already got women 45 and over. I need to get another group and bring them into the fold. So I used my books almost like being a literary Pied Piper. If I find an audience out there that's not currently reading me, I will write something that targets that particular audience and brings them back. All of my books have a common thread of suspense, so that's kind of how I keep everybody together. The voice is very similar, you know, so even if you read something that I write that's got a lot of sci-fi in it, it's still going to feel very familiar to you as a reader. So even if you don't normally read sci-fi, you're still going to like it. And that's kind of the goal. And, you know, it's not something I stumbled into. I studied the great names out there. I studied guys like Stephen King and James Patterson and Dean Koontz, you know, the brand names where you walk into a bookstore and you buy the book because their name is on the cover. You don't even look to see what it's about. You just know it's going to be a good story. So I researched the hell out of those kind of guys and basically folded that into my business model. And that's what I've been following.
When you have like agents giving you this information or your editors giving you this information, and I've spoken to agents who've said anyone who tells you they know what's going to sell or they know what the public wants or they know what the publishers are going to pick up just is lying, right? So like you right. do so much that's counter to like the common wisdom, right? And you're trying new things all the time and they work. They're incredibly successful. Do you think there's a danger of sort of the herd mentality in like New York publishing where people are just trying to repeat past successes, not understanding that maybe people are looking for something a little different?
Absolutely. I mean, a good one to study is Gillian Flynn. She was a writer for, I believe it was Entertainment Weekly. She got a 3-book deal and her first couple of books came out and they did okay. But they didn't hit it out of the park. They didn't do what she was hoping they would do. And then all of a sudden she has Gone Girl, which was just insane as far as the kind of reception it got. But when she was trying to sell Gone Girl, if you read, you know, interviews that she's done, she had a very hard time because, you know, editors, publishers, they didn't really understand the concept of an unreliable narrator, not on that scale. It was so different. And that's, you know, it's one of those things where I think it's almost like a baseball player taking a swing for the fence. Like you're going to go for the fence. You're either going to strike out or you're going to hit that home run. It's like one or the other. And Gone Girl and a lot of these types of projects are very much like that. You know, like it either would have completely fizzled because it was so different, nobody would get it, which is kind of the way the industry felt about it when they first saw it. Or it's this, you know, insane home run that hits it out of the park and that everybody wants to be that book. And if you search titles, it's really funny, like Gone Girl as a title, like that particular year, there were only a handful of books that came out with like Gone or Girl in the title. The following year, it's like 400 or 500 books came out with one of those two words in the title, everybody chasing it. That's the position you want to be in. I think you have to operate outside the box. It doesn't matter if you're selling bananas or you're selling books. You have to do something different to stand out in that crowd.
So when you're an agent and you understand that, like, New York Publishing can be, you know, fairly conservative because they're looking at something to succeed, and if they don't, the acquiring editor's really gone out on a limb, right? If you're trying something completely different and it flops. So if you're an agent and you and that's your job to sell to these acquiring editors, how do you, would you as an agent, like, evaluate what is different enough, but, you know, that stands on its own merit? Because you hear this all the time. Something's really good, but I can't sell it. It's really good, but how do I shelve it, right? It's, you know, it's a mix of genre that hasn't been done before. And then, of course, if it blows up, everybody wants the same thing. So how do you think they evaluate that? Because it doesn't happen a lot. Are we missing something as an artistic community where a lot of, like, really unique works are just sort of going unseen?
I think the industry itself just likes to play it safe. You know, it's sort of like a Marvel movie. You know, they've got tons of great movies they could make, but they know they're going to make money doing another Marvel movie, so they tend to throw all the resources behind that instead of these 50 other projects that may or may not do well. You know, the book industry is no different than that. Like, when you send your book into an agent, they immediately try to put you in a box. They need to say you are a this author. You know, you're a romance author, you're this, you're that. They have to put you in that box, so when they pick up the phone and talk to an editor, they can say this person writes this. That editor has to pick up the phone and talk to the marketing people, and they need to understand what you write. And the marketing people talk to the bookstores, and they need to understand where they're going to put you on a shelf. So, like, all these things have to line up. But the unfortunate part of that is once you fall into that, it's very difficult to get out of it. It's very difficult to stand, you know, alone from everybody else and basically break out in a meaningful way. You know, I had this conversation with a couple of big name authors before I actually started publishing on my own, because I didn't want to get stuck, you know, in a situation where I was writing the same book but different every year. I love to pick on Lee Child. You know, Lee Child, he's a fantastic writer. I love the Reacher books, but that's actually not his real name. If you go to his Wikipedia page, his real name is on there. He was writing books under different pen names, and the Jack Reacher books just happened to take off. So before he knew it, he's writing a new Reacher book year after year after year. To me, that's like Groundhog Day. I don't want to get stuck in doing that. I like to mix it up. So when I came out of the gate, I purposely wrote a horror novel, which is honestly my favorite thing to write. Then I followed that up with a thriller. Then I wrote another horror novel, and I bounced back and forth, which my agents, my editors, everybody hated because they couldn't put me in that particular box. But I used that common thread of suspense, and I kept telling them, like, what's going to end up happening is people are going to start crossing over from one genre to the other. They're going to start reading all of it. You're going to see it. It may not happen at the beginning, but if you go back and study all these big names that have pulled this off, that's what happened. But it can take 5, 10, 15 years sometimes for that to play out. And a lot of times they're not willing to stay on board for that kind of, you know, long game. But in my case, it's happening now. I've got publishers, you know, all around the world. To give you an example, in Spain, I sell a ton of books in Spanish, but the first one that actually hit up well was The Fourth Monkey. So they put out that series, and then they started skipping over my horror novels. You know, so I put out a horror novel every other book, so they would skip those, and they would just put out the thrillers. But, you know, over the last year or two, they've circled back, and they said, okay, we want the other ones. And they bought every horror novel that I wrote in between, because they are now seeing that the audience has gotten big enough and willing to step out there and read these different parts. So, you know, again, as an author, I think you have to, first of all, just write the book you want to write, tell the story you want to tell, but then take a step back from that and just look at, you know, like, what can I do to market this? What can I do to be a little bit different? And try to double down on the fact that you're not like everybody else. You know, that can be a leg up. You know, last year, 4 million books were published. You know, your book is going to be one of them. You know, you need to somehow stand out in that crowd.
Do you think that, like, there's always a blend of genres, right, in all books? Do you think the reason, like, The Fourth Monkey is a serial killer book stood out? Was it the concept, because, oh, the person's dead at the beginning, so it's a very unique high concept? Or do you think it was partially the blend of, like, horror with it, right? Because there's some really graphic scenes. There's some things, like, that your agent wanted to cut out. Do you think that led to it? Is it that you didn't put yourself in a box when you wrote this?
So I think it was both. When my agent sold it, the selling point was the fact that the serial killer dies at the very beginning. This is why it's different. This is why you want to read it. But once people read it, those horror elements made it stand out. You know, those readers are used to reading thrillers that are very, you know, vanilla. They've got a, you know, police procedural. There's a certain formula you follow. You know, that's what they expected to see. So when I threw these horror elements in there, all of a sudden there's something a little bit different that makes it stand out from everybody else. And that's honestly, it's what you want to do. I love to read, and I read a lot of stuff outside my genre. I've got two romance novels sitting on my coffee table over here. And I grab little pieces of these different things and fold them in. You know, romance, I think, is a fantastic genre for every author to read, simply because you can put a romance into a sci-fi novel, you can put it into a Western, you can put it into anything else, but you need to understand how to write it. Reading is the best learning thing that's out there, the best learning tool.
You know, romance readers are some of my favorite people. Having this literary salon, I get to meet readers every day. They come in here, and the romance readers are fantastic. We do some big romanticy authors who come in here, and they sell out in like 2 days. You know, it's a really, yeah, really fun. But their enthusiasm is infectious, right? It's like your enthusiasm for writing and for story. All these readers have that. And I notice this kind of disconnect, too, because they don't believe in just one thing. They might like romanticism, but they'll talk to me and they're like, oh, I love reading mysteries, you know, and I love, oh, thrillers are fantastic. I love a good thriller. And so I think there is this disconnect between agents and publishers and what the readers actually are looking for.
Well, again, they're looking at they're looking to you to be a product. And for you to be a product, you have to be definable as a thing, one particular thing. They've already got romance writers on their catalog. They've already got Western writers. They've got these. They've got that. They need you to be whatever it is they're paying you to be. But you need to take a step back again, look at this as a business, and decide if that's the best situation for you. There's little things in this industry that kind of jump out at you when you've been doing it for a long time. So like when you have your first book published, a lot of times the title of the book is this big and the author name is like this down at the very bottom, and it's mainly because the publisher is selling that particular title. They're not selling you. And for you as an author, you need to sell you. Like, you need to be the brand. You need to be the thing that everybody is looking for when they walk into that store. That's how you become the household name. But that's completely counterproductive to what the publisher is trying to do. So like, it's two totally different things that have to come together. You have to be willing to fight for that.
When you mentioned Lee Child and writing the same thing, was this was your first series, right? The 4MK series, originally, yeah, a standalone. So when you go back and you write prequels, is that sort of a way to like re-energize your creativity and your enthusiasm a little bit when you've been writing like in the same world for a little bit? Is it like, it's a different take, right, than just doing like another one in a row?
Yeah, it was. I like writing standalones because I basically get a clean slate every time, brand new characters and place and all that. But this was fun because I had characters I knew. It almost feels like the lead detective is standing in the corner of my office, just tapping his foot all the time, waiting for me to tell more of his stories. It's like I knew that was out there, but like I had to go back. I listened to all the audiobooks for the three that I wrote all over again. Took very detailed notes of every plot point, every twist. Looked for little things that I could exploit in the prequels, because I basically have to take a series where I flip it on its head like three or four times through the series. Like, it's a very twisty series. I have to do it all over again in a way that is new, and that's not easy to do. And to top it, to make it more difficult, like, I have to do it in a way where the reading order doesn't necessarily matter, because a lot of people are reading basically books 4, 5, and 6, now going back reading books 1, 2, and 3. So that's going to give you a very different experience than reading 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. But they both have to hit in a particular way. They both have to work, in a particular way. So there's a lot of moving parts that you have to bring together, which again is one of the reasons why I did this without telling anybody, because I wasn't sure I'd be able to pull it off.
How do you balance like the reader who's read your previous books and then they're going to go back to a prequel with a first time reader who's picking this up and saying, oh, prequels before the series, I can start with this book. Like, how do you write it without too many, giving up too much information?
Well, for the most part, people tend to read this series in order, which is good. If you read one and you pick it up like in the middle, like, it still kind of works. But like, this is one of those things. It's fashioned in a lot of ways after Star Wars. Like, you could start with Empire Strikes Back, but do you really want to? Like, you really want to start at the very beginning. So I encourage people to do that. For the most part, I think starting with Fourth Monkey, even today with the three prequels, if they were out there, I would say start with the Fourth Monkey. Read 4, 5, and 6, then go back and read 1, 2, and 3. And who knows? There may be more after that.
So when you're, I'm always curious how story comes to writers. When you're creating these characters at the beginning, is it character first with you when you're first coming with your idea? Do you come up with a character, or is it the unique situation, the sort of the plot first idea generation?
Every book that I've written, I think, has come together in a different way. I've got an app on my phone. It's a note-taking app, and I've got a file just called Ideas, and I just randomly just drop whatever ideas I have into there. To give you an example, I had a book a few years ago called Behind a Closed Door. And in my idea app, I had a husband and wife, character. Like, I knew I wanted to write about these two. It's a husband and wife. They've been married for about 10 years. They still love each other, but, they're kind of leading separate lives because they have different jobs. They see each other in passing, more or less. Both come home from work, eat a quick meal, watch an hour of Netflix, fall asleep, kind of rinse and repeat. And they've sort of drifted apart over this decade. And the husband gets very close to cheating. He doesn't actually do it, but it almost happens. And it's a wake-up moment for the two of them. I knew I wanted to start them in a therapist office, but I didn't know anything beyond that. That idea is in there. And it was sitting in that app for probably 5 or 6 years. And then one day, my wife and I, we were sitting over dinner and we were talking, and she does a lot of real estate. And she had just bought a house in Georgia that was a fairly big house. It had 7 bathrooms in it. And we were just talking about what needed to be renovated in this house. And just out of the blue, I just mentioned, well, you should check out that company Bath Fitters. And we've all seen the commercials, they come in, they retrofit a bathroom in one day. But that's all, we basically just discussed it over the dinner table. We didn't type anything into a device, nothing like that. But that night, we both noticed commercials for Bath Fitters start to pop up on our phones and our social media feeds, on television. So I started to research this and realized in the terms of service for our phones, we give them permission to listen to us 24/7. So my phone is sitting right in front of me. It's listening to this conversation. It's grabbing keywords out of the air, dropping those into a database, and those are used to target and market me later, which is some scary stuff. So I started thinking, what happens if that information ends up in the wrong hands? I mean, in real life, it probably is in the wrong hands. So that's a totally different idea from the husband and wife. So then I took these two things and I put them together. So we're back to our husband and wife. They're in the therapist office, and the therapist talks to them, realizes what's going on, and she recommends that they download an app to their phone called Sugar and Spice, which is essentially Truth or Dare for adults, to spice up their marriage. So that app basically is behind a lot of this data, so that the two different things kind of came together. And once I had those parts, it was off to the races. It's almost like chocolate and peanut butter, like two things that don't seem like they should work together, work really well together. To me, the stories kind of come together the same way.
I do that all the time. I think it's a great idea for writers to combine ideas into multiple plots. When you're looking at these characters, then people look at it differently. They call it a misbelief with the character. When you're looking at character arc and something they have to understand, or it's a flaw they have to overcome, or a phobia or whatever. When you're looking at your characters at the beginning, do you know where they're going to end up, as a character, that internal change that happens within them?
Sometimes I do, and sometimes I don't. Another example, I had a book called A Caller's Game. It's about a radio DJ, and somebody calls in live on the air and confesses to murder, and then starts to continue actually committing murder live on the air. So that was one of the ideas in my little book. It sat there for years and years, and one day I'm looking at it, and I think the opening line was a Howard Stern-like DJ. That kind of got me hung up, because I started thinking of Howard Stern as this person for the longest time. And then one morning I looked at it, I was like, well, what if this was a woman? And that completely changes the dynamic, because if you think of some of the opinions that Howard Stern has, they work in a certain way because it's Howard Stern. If it was a woman that was saying these things, it's a totally different dynamic. And I love that particular dynamic. So I ended up writing the book, and my lead DJ is a woman named Jordan Briggs. That's what made that work. But as far as her as a character, I didn't know where she was going. I didn't know where the story was going. I used to pants a lot of my novels. I'm guessing your audience is familiar with the different writing terms. I used to do that all the time, because that's what Stephen King said you're supposed to do. But then I started writing books with James Patterson, and he kind of, brought me over to the outlining camp. I realized that it's a lot more efficient for me to outline a book. I can make changes wholesale through an outline before I start writing, and basically dial that book in and get it 100% perfect before I actually write that first page. And then any brain power I put into it is basically towards making that book better, because I already know what the story is. So I've been outlining ever since. And having an outline, I do in a certain way have that character arc already down on paper. But a lot of times it changes. My outlines are very dynamic. I think that's where a lot of writers actually go wrong with it. They create an outline, they start writing their book based on that outline, they get to chapter 3, then they get a new idea, they start going off in this direction, the outline's over here, and before you know it, they're not looking at it anymore. What I actually do when I get that idea out of left field, I'll go through the entire outline and adjust for it. And I constantly do that as I'm writing the book. So the outline changes, it's basically 4 or 5 chapters ahead of where I'm actually writing at any given moment, but it's always right there with me.
Do you think that ability to see story before you're writing it, without working out characters on the page, with doing some sort of outlining, is that a skill that you have to develop? Is that a way to, like, train your brain? Because I'm curious, because every time a spectrum, right, even though the biggest discovery writers tend to have an idea where things are going, or they have an idea where they want a character, or they have the last scene or whatever, and a lot of outliners will pants as they write. So, I mean, do you think that's something that anyone can just pick up, or is that something you have to work at as a writer? Like you, when you started working with Patterson, and he's a big outliner with these huge outlines, is that something that took you some time to learn how to do that? Was that a skill you had to develop?
I've always had a beginning, something that's going to happen in the middle, and an ending in mind when I write the book. And a lot of times those elements will change, but I think it's important before you write that first word that you know how the book is going to end, because it gives your subconscious kind of a destination, something to shoot for. I think if you don't have that, you end up with that book that kind of meanders for a long time. You get 400,000 words on the page and you don't actually have a real story there, because you're just following these characters through all these different things. But if you have an ending in the back of your mind somewhere, you're always shooting for that. And I think that's important.
So you mentioned, like, when people are doing this, these are mistakes they make. You did book doctoring at the beginning, right? Before you were ghostwriting, you were doing some book doctoring. What were the major craft issues or problems with books? Did you see, like, any through lines with writers when publishers came to you and said, can you fix this? Like, what were people doing wrong?
One of the things I almost did on literally every book is I would cut the first chapter, the first couple of chapters, because I would start reading and there would be, you know, all this world building. There would be something to establish who the character is. You know, they're waking up, you're going through their day, like all this stuff happens before the actual thing happens that, you know, really launches the book. So I would look for that thing that really launches the book and cut everything before it and start with that as the opening, because that's your hook. You know, now all of a sudden you're grabbing readers with whatever that thing is. And you can always take all that information that you're cutting out and you can seed it somewhere else in the book. You can still get it out, but it's all about distribution and making sure you put it out in the right place. So that was the one thing I probably saw the most. People just tend to, you know, do tons of expedition. They think they have to lay everything out. It's not necessary. One of the things that Patterson taught me, which seems very simple when you look back on it, but like whenever an author writes a chapter, subconsciously we create a beginning, middle, and an end. Like we wrap up that chapter with some type of closure. So one of the things that he taught me to do is go back through every chapter and cut the ending of it. So you take out the last sentence, you take out the last paragraph. You know, a lot of times just doing that little bit is enough to create that cliffhanger moment that forces people to have to turn the page, you know, to move on. So I look for a lot of that kind of stuff when I you know, work with other people. Dialogue was always a problem, you know, with a lot, especially new authors. It's not believable. It doesn't sound realistic. I often tell writers to, like, go into a coffee shop, eavesdrop on the table next to you with your laptop there, and write it out. You know, listen to that conversation. Listen to how broken it is. People don't talk in perfect sentences, particularly if they're amped up. You know, then you get a lot of contractions, you get a lot of ums and stuff like that. Put it all down on paper, though. If you listen to it and you physically type it out, you're going to see what that looks like. And you can train your brain to actually write dialogue just by doing that. And it only works with live situations. It's got to be a coffee shop. It's got to be a real conversation. If you try to do it with a TV show or a movie, that dialogue is already filtered. It's already been edited. It's already been, you know, written by somebody. It's not real. And, you know, I think a lot of authors would benefit from listening to their dialogue out loud. Pretty much every writing program in today's world will read your book to you. You know, take advantage of that. See what it sounds like when somebody actually says those words. Make sure it makes sense.
Why do you think that is, that, like, hearing the dialogue makes such a difference, or, like, reading something on a white piece of paper as opposed to on a computer screen? Like, your brain processes it differently. Why do you think that matters so much in editing?
Well, when we read, we don't actually read everything that we're looking at. There's puzzles out there where, you know, it's like a block of text and the first and last letter of every word is correct, but everything in between is scrambled, and your brain can still read it because we're not reading every individual letter, every single word. Your brain fills in those blanks. So if there's errors on the page, your brain is going to account for that, particularly if it's your own writing, because your brain knows what the next word is. It knows what you have down on paper, whether you remember it or not, your brain actually does. So it will skip over mistakes. You may think you have a particular word in there, like, you know, you might leave out the letter A, or the word the. You might leave it out. Your brain is going to completely skip over it, not even notice that you left that out. So a lot of things like that. Like, it's important to trust, you know, the process.
So when you're seeing, like, all these mistakes when you're a book doctor and you're ghostwriting, I'm curious about, like, the psychological impact of when your books, you hit the New York Times list a bunch of times, right? As without your name on the book. That must be really weird because you wrote something that made it, but also your name's not on it. How does that feel?
It's frustrating. You know, like I was working in finance when the last one hit up. I had six of them that came out like that. And number six hit up. And like, my wife pulled me aside. She's like, I know you want to become a full-time author. We need to come up with a way to make this happen. Because it's just, I knew at that point what I was doing. You know, I had worked with so many agents and editors. Initially, I was just working for authors, just editing and cleaning up their own book. But eventually that turned into, editors contacting me. I had New York Times bestsellers that weren't able to finish their book because they had to go out on a book tour. And they would hand those projects off to me to actually finish because I could write in their voice. So I was working hand in hand with some of the bestsellers in the world, learning exactly what little, tricks and things they did in order to get that book to resonate so well with readers. So like all that knowledge is up here. For better or worse, and I had to get out there and take advantage of it.
What about when you're co-writing now? Because you did a bunch of books with James Patterson, but you're also bringing on your own co-writers at this point. How is that process different? And is it hard for you, like as a creative, to share the storytelling with another person, or does it help?
No, I love it. To give you an example, I've got a book called Heavier the Stones, and I wrote that with a woman named Christine Daigle. She's on my podcast with me. In real life, she's a neuropsychologist, so she was able to bring that skill set to the page. So when we hashed out scenes, when we hashed out dialogue, we were able to take advantage of that. And me as an author, I could fake it. I can watch some Netflix specials, I can do some Google searches, and I can become an astronaut or become this or become that. But having an authentic voice, that knowledge base in the writing room with you is priceless. So I see the co-authors almost as like another writing tool in the toolbox. They allow me to tell a story I couldn't tell on my own. And it works for them too, because I'm teaching them how to write. I'm teaching them all this knowledge that I've picked up. I'm passing that on to them. So like it's a win-win for both of us.
How do you find and vet authors when you want to work on a project together, right? Because it's a big time commitment and you're a busy guy.
Yeah, it's tricky because I get a lot of people that send me stuff. What I really look for, I really think there's something called the storyteller gene. I think some people are able to tell a story and other ones want to, but they don't necessarily, they're not able to. You can teach somebody grammar and punctuation and all these other things, but you can't teach them that storyteller gene. It's almost like if you're sitting around a campfire, there's always going to be that one person who can just captivate everybody. And then there's a person sitting next to them who can't do it at all. So I look for that storyteller gene in the writing. And when I see that, then I also look for things that they might be doing that I have fixed in the past as a book doctor. So if I see that they are doing something that can be fixed, something that I can help them with, and it's basically those are the two things that I'm really shooting for. And a lot of them are, they're indie authors that have hit a certain plateau. They've got 20, 30 books out there, but they're not selling at the level that they want to, and they don't understand why. And I think a lot of that has to do with the indie world. And I love indie authors. I love the entire process, but it's missing a little something. So when you're traditionally published, you've got an agent who's going through that book and telling you everything that needs to be fixed. Then it goes to an editor. Then there might be a secondary editor, maybe a developmental editor, but there's this huge process. And when you go through that process, it teaches you how to improve your storytelling. So if you've got a particular issue, that's going to get weeded out in that process. But if you're an indie author, a lot of times you're hiring editors, you're hiring people to read through the book. So that whatever that issue is, it tends to stick in the books. First book, fifth book, 10th book, 20th book, that issue is always there and readers pick up on it. So that's what keeps them from going from this level to the next level. So I try to spot those kind of things, things that I can teach them to get them to take it to the next level.
Into what, other than like subject matter expertise, how have your co-writers, how has Patterson impacted you? How has some of your new co-writers impacted you? There must be, because you're working together, there must be some change on both sides of that equation.
Yeah, I learn a lot of new things, and I still see, writing styles that, are things that, even with a co-author that I want to implement on my own side. I pick up new things. Patterson and I, we were supposed to write one book together. We're having so much fun. We're on book like six or seven. And I do it because I enjoy the process. Every time I've got this guy on the phone, he is teaching me something new, not only about writing, but about the business side. And I try to pass down that same knowledge to my co-authors. As a business owner, selfishly, I'm now able to put out a lot more titles than I could if I just wrote on my own. That's no accident. You know, just like I had looked at guys like Stephen King and Dean Koontz and, you know, those guys before to figure out how do I build a brand. I'm looking at James Patterson's business model and going, this guy might be onto something. So I'm following a very similar trajectory.
I love this idea of the storytelling gene that you just mentioned. You were writing at a very early age, right? Do you remember the first time that you were really captivated by story? I think I saw that you read the Hardy Boys. And by the way, I can't tell you, I would say 90% of the authors I've interviewed have been either influenced by Nancy Drew or the Hardy Boys. It's crazy.
Those are some great books. I've got almost the entire collection out in a library over there. I think I'm missing like five. But I started off reading those. We didn't have a TV in the house, so you know, I grew up reading from a very early age. This was the 70s. There's nothing worth watching anyway. I started with the Hardy Boys and Nancy Drew. Then I moved on to the classics like Charles Dickens and Mark Twain and really loved all of those. One day I was at a yard sale with my mom and a guy had a box of books and Dracula was sitting up on the top. I was 8 years old and I picked it up and I read the back. I was like, there's no way my mom's going to let me buy this because it seemed too scary. It seemed like an adult book. Like something that I shouldn't be reading yet. But she let me get it and I took it home and I read it over a couple weeks and it scared the bejesus out of me. I slept with the lights on. I was looking under my bed, opening the closet door. And that was honestly the first time I had ever gotten an emotional reaction out of a book. And I've been chasing that feeling ever since as a reader and a writer. I think shortly after that, I discovered Stephen King and went through all of those, which I think is why, today, like writing horror is still my favorite.
So how cool was it for you when later on you wrote Dracul and you were able to read original diaries and entries? Like that must have been something because it came right from your childhood.
Yeah, I mean, that book just keeps coming back. So Dracul, Bram Stoker's family reached out to me and asked if I'd like to write a prequel to Dracula using all of Bram's original notes and journals. The answer to that is yes. You always say yes when somebody asks you a question like that. And it was a very surreal moment because I had material that was on Bram Stoker's desk literally right in front of me. When we finished up the book, we got to see the original manuscript. I had learned that Paul Allen had bought it at an auction at Christie's years back, and he had the only copy. So Dacre Stoker, who's Bram's great-grandnephew, and I, we flew out to Seattle and we got locked in a conference room and got to flip through the original manuscript and not only see, the original typescript, but Bram's handwritten notes, all over it. There's a scene with Renfeld, where they drill holes in his head to relieve some pressure. Bram's brother, Thornley, was a doctor. So in the margins of the original manuscript, he actually drew a skull and showed Bram where those holes would need to be drilled in order for this to work. It was so amazing to see all that and be part of that.
That is so cool. So has your relationship to story changed like since you were a kid? And you're young, your mind's developing, everything's new to you. Now you're a professional, you've got all these books out, you understand you've peeked behind the curtain. Like do you still get the same joy and excitement when you start a book or when you get a story idea, or has it changed?
I think it gets harder to get that, that little bit of excitement because I've read so many books. I feel like I've read every story. I've seen so many TV shows. I feel like I've seen every show, every movie, every storyline. So when somebody surprises me, like to me, that again is that same feeling that I got when I discovered Dracula. All of a sudden I'm getting something brand new. So if I'm watching a show where there's a twist that I didn't think of myself or I didn't see coming, that's a huge moment for me. And as a writer, that's what I'm chasing. I don't want to recreate something that's already been done over and over again. I want to create something new. So it's elusive, but it's there. And when you find it, it's priceless.
You mentioned at the beginning about writing the thing that you want to read or about the thing you want to write, telling the story that's organic to you. Do you do anything in particular to like stoke that creative energy or those juices? Is there anything you do? Is there like any ritual or places you want to be or things that you do that put you in that creative mindset where you have like fertile ground for storytelling?
I don't think it works that way, to be honest with you. My best ideas have come to me when I'm doing the most mundane things. I'm doing the dishes, walking the dog, I'm out on a run, in the shower. If I sit down in front of my computer and say, okay, create an idea right now, it doesn't happen. But if I'm, out back building a treehouse for my daughter, all of a sudden some weird idea will pop into my head. And that's what, I take that and I run.
So do you think your subconscious is always working on this? And when you're doing something mundane and letting your mind just sort of wander from idea to idea, that's when they come into your consciousness?
I think that's what it is. I think when we're doing something like a repetitive type task where your mind can wander, you have to be willing to let it go a little bit and grab onto the good ideas when they show up.
That's how I started dictating, by the way. I think I talked about that on your podcast, because I'd run, and then when my mind was just wandering and I'd end up taking so many notes, I'm like, why don't I just write the thing while I'm running?
I wish I could dictate. I have tried that so many times, because I go on a 4-mile run every day. I live on a little island. And I do a lap around the island, but I can never get it to work. Like I feel weird talking to my phone, or you know, just talking out loud, and like I never get the stories to come out that way. If I could, my word count would probably be insane.
Yeah,
it's kind of fast.
It's definitely a different skill, but I wrote a whole book 15 minutes at a time just dictating. So I want to talk to you about, I have to ask you about this, about like some of your really unique and innovative marketing ideas. You had the haunted house on the island where you did a contest, right? And you asked readers, and then several of them spent the night on the island. Do you walk me through your process when you're coming through something real, because you're constantly doing things that people haven't done before, unique things to market your books. How does that come to you, like story, or do you sit down with like a procedure to go through to figure out how you're going to get this book out there?
It's a little bit of both again. You know, like when you try to force it, it doesn't necessarily happen. But with every book that's coming out, I try to look at what everybody else is doing to market their books. Maybe I'll make a list of that. And then I try to come up with something that nobody is doing. And my general thinking is, you know, like if you've got a book coming out and, you do what everybody else is doing, you buy Amazon ads, you buy Facebook ads, you know, you do all that stuff, you're going to do okay, but you're never going to do better than the other people that are doing those exact same things. So you need to come up with something different. So the example that you brought up last year, I had a book called Something I Keep Upstairs. It's a haunted house story, but it's based on a real haunted house. It's a little house that's on a private island right off the coast of the island where I live. I know the people who own it. So as I was finishing up that book, I thought, hey, wouldn't it be cool to give away an overnight stay? So ultimately, that's what I did. I created a contest. We picked one name. That person was allowed to take three of their friends. We took them out to this private island by boat, dropped them off on the dock, and said, okay, you get to stay in a haunted house for 24 hours. We'll come back for you. And we literally left them on this private island for 24 hours and then picked them up the next day. But the buzz that created was insane, because all of a sudden I've got this haunted house book coming out about a real haunted house. You know, so the press just ate that up. Here's an author who's given away an overnight stay in a real haunted house based, you know, the basis of his book. So I did a lot of television, a lot of radio, a lot of podcasts, just talking about that. All of that was free. And it created a ton of word of mouth, because people wanted to enter that contest. You know, if you jumped on Facebook, you'd see people just chatting like, I'll do it. Will you do it? I'll do it if you do it. I won't do it. I'm going to do it. But like all that word of mouth is, you know, created buzz for the book. And then ultimately it created the sales on the backside. So I'm always looking for that. Doesn't always work. You know, sometimes I put, you know, my foot in my mouth. But, you know, I think you have to be willing to take that chance.
So that was so genius about that one in particular, right? Because it had so many levels, like leading up to the contest, the regular marketing you do with the book, then the press got in that you're giving this thing away, then people actually going out there and wondering what's going to happen, and then talking about it afterwards. It was like the gift that kept giving, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's funny because now we're a couple years out. The house itself has been turned into a museum, so you can take tours of it. And they actually decorated the interior of the house to match what I had in the book, because we had all been working together through this whole process, and they just really liked the book idea. Being in New England, we've got a lot of haunted stuff. So like there are, I think, 3 or 4 ghost tours that take place in Portsmouth, the town right next door to me. All of those ghost tours, they sell my book in their gift shops. The island itself, I think they just placed an order for a couple hundred of them, you know, to sell out on the island. And my story has actually become part of the local lore, which is funny because like they want to tell the history of this particular island, but all these tourists are coming in because they're reading about it in the book and they want to see what they saw in the book. And if you go out there, you know, you kind of get a mix of both. You know, there's people that are literally standing there with my book, people listening to the audiobook while they're walking around the island. It's a very surreal experience as an author.
That's so cool, that like sort of multimedia approach too, like, well, beyond media, right? The real life, being able to touch things in the real world. I've noticed that like in the romanticy and in some fantasy, people are doing book covers that are a lot more intricate now and have texture. And, you know, there's this almost this desire, especially with younger people, to be able to have something that's not digital, something that's real. Do you think there's an opportunity to maybe re-envision the way we do storytelling, in that there's that interactive thing where people can physically go and do something, you know, maybe some kind of a, you know, readings or acting or interactive experience? Do you think storytelling can change a little bit because of the way we're in this digital landscape?
I think it should, and I think people should be looking at that. You know, like when I go out to that island, there are people that are standing in the living room reading my book, you know, reading a particular scene that took place in the room where they're standing, you know, which brings on a feeling that you're not going to get anywhere else. It's almost like, you know, you can watch a Taylor Swift concert on TV if you want, or you can go to a Taylor Swift concert. And that feeling that you get of being in a live audience with that performer right there is so different, and it can't be replicated. And I'm only bringing up Taylor Swift because I've got an 8-year-old. I'm kind of stuck in that. But like those kind of feelings, I think you can, you know, you can combine them. And I think authors should be looking at that and look at ways to do it, you know, that haven't been done yet.
You have a bunch of books that have been optioned, right? How many in all? You know, it's a lot, isn't it?
I need to total it up again, but at last count, I had 8 different projects that were in various stages of Hollywood hell.
For you as like an author, do you get as excited about that as you do, say, when your book's coming out? Like, is it because they're very different things, right?
My answer depends on whether or not my film agent is listening right now. the truth is the book is the only thing that I've got control over. And film and TV is a very weird thing. Like if you watch the credits at the end of a movie, you know, 5 or 6 minutes of names just going by, every single person mentioned there had to be there in order for that movie to get to the screen. And that's very much what it's like in real life. And it's this huge roller coaster. So every time my film agent calls me, it's either really good news or really bad news. To give you an example, A Caller's Game, that book we were talking about, Ridley Scott's company optioned it from get-go. But then it kind of sat there for a while, maybe 6 months or so. And then I got a phone call from my agent. He said, hey, Jennifer Garner is interested in this. So we did a Zoom call with Jennifer Garner's people. She had what's called a first look deal with Netflix. Netflix offered up $100 billion budget as a starting point. So all these pieces kind of came together over maybe 2 to 3 weeks. So it was a very short time frame. And then we got another phone call. Jennifer Garner's got a scheduling conflict. She's going to have to do something else. She's going to have to back out of this project. Mm-hmm. So Jennifer Garner goes away, Netflix goes away, the $100 billion budget goes away, and you're right back to where you started from. So every one of those things is, you know, way up here or way down here. So you just got to take it with a grain of salt. In my mind, you know, like it's a numbers game. You know, like I keep getting optioned over and over again. Every time I put out a new book, that's another option that's floating around out there. Sooner or later, I will have my butt in a seat at the theater watching my own thing. But it hasn't happened yet.
You know, I feel like you're at the cutting edge of so much of this. You know, you've had so much success in this area. How, and this is an impossible question, but I want to ask you about the publishing industry and how it's changed. You said 4 million books came out last year. I think 3.5 million of them were self-published, right? There's a lot of noise that's out there. You've had a tremendous success as a hybrid author. Like, what do you see the way forward is for authors?
I indie published the first title, but I sold a lot of copies of it, which put me on the radar of the traditional guys. Fourth Monkey, which was my first traditional title, sold for a lot of money. And I had a few of those right after that. But because I'd gotten a taste of being an indie author and the economics of it, it was hard to forget that. The fact that as an indie, you get to basically control everything. You know, you get to pick your own covers. You know, like in the traditional world, they can change the title of your book, they can change the cover, they can do whatever they want. So I did a couple of books in the traditional world, then I started doing the hybrid thing, like what you had just mentioned. So I basically published in English on my own through my own press, and then I let my agent sell all the foreign rights, which I thought was a great mix, and it kind of was. But there were still places that I couldn't get into because I was still an indie author. You know, so my books weren't in Target, they weren't in Walmart, they weren't in Costco or the grocery store. A couple of years ago, I signed a deal with Simon & Schuster. They let me create my own imprint at Simon & Schuster, which is what I'm doing today. So because I'm my own publishing house, I have to pay for the print runs. I have to pay for that side of it as a publisher. But the economic benefits are very strong because I'm the publisher and I'm the author. But I've got Simon & Schuster as the backbone. They handle my print sales and distribution. So because of that, I'm able to get into all these places I couldn't get into as an indie author. I think that's where publishing itself is actually going. If you take like a big name indie author, let's say you've got somebody who's making millions of dollars every time they put out a book, and there's a lot of them out there, if a traditional publisher comes up to them and says, okay, I'll give you a check for $1 million for that next book. They're going to say no, because they know they can make that money on their own without the hassle of having to deal with that third party. But if that same publisher comes to them and says, well, why don't we split the economics down the middle? You can use our sales and distribution system so we can get your book into all these different places. All of a sudden that becomes a business relationship that makes sense. So I think you're going to see more of that. I think you're going to see more of the big publishers reaching out to the better selling indie authors and trying to strike some kind of deal in the middle. And they have to, because honestly, like, the current traditional model it's broken. It's aging out. A lot of the big name authors, if you walk into a Barnes & Noble and look at the names that you see there, the same names that have been there for the last 20, 30 years, those authors are getting older. And those publishers aren't doing anything to replenish that livestock. They've got no big names coming up in the pipeline. They're dependent solely on those big names that are out there now. So if they don't change something soon, they're going to be in trouble.
And half of those authors, those big name authors, are deceased, right? And there's people writing under their estates. You see that more and more.
There's that too. And honestly, with AI out there, that really scares me, because it's going to get easier and easier to do it.
So since AI is so good at mimicry, how do you think AI, I know some writers, there's been a couple of big kind of scandals recently, right, where authors have been using AI to write. How much of that are we going to have to deal with as authors, you think? How much of that 4 million, is that going to go to 40 million, the titles coming out a year because of AI?
It might, but the only one you need to worry about is your own. I double down on my voice, and if you get an email, let's say, that was written by ChatGPT, I think we're all at the point where we can recognize ChatGPT's voice. It's got its own unique voice, as crazy as that sounds. It's its own author. So I think sooner or later, AI might get good enough to be able to write a decent or a compelling story, but it's going to just be another author that's out there. I don't really see it as competition, because of the way I'm building my business model. I'm building a brand. People are coming to me because of my particular voice. I'm doubling down on that. I'm doubling down on the fact that I'm human, and I can create something unique. Today's world, luckily, AI just can't write well enough to pull it off. But I think that day is coming. When you write a thriller, you need to make 1 + 1 = 3. You have to be able to do something different. AI doesn't understand that. It can rehash what it's been told, but it can't do something creative like that. But one day it's going to have a creative spark, and it is going to be able to do it. I think as authors need to be ready for that. But it's going to be competition. It's not going to be I personally like writing. You can hand me a pad of paper and a pen, and I will sit there and I will write a novel for you. I don't need anything else in order to do it. And I like that process. I wouldn't want to introduce something like AI into that. Some authors do. I don't know. It's up to you.
It feels like to me, if you're a storyteller, you have this gift. And if you're using AI to do it, somehow you're not respecting the gift that you've been given. Does that make sense?
Well, it does. And I think writing is very much like exercising a muscle. And, let's say you start using AI for little cheats, AI, tell me how to describe this room for me. And, you use that description in your book. All of a sudden, your brain's not creating that description anymore. And that portion of your brain that could create that description is going to get weaker. It's going to become more and more hard for you to be able to do that. I purposely steer clear of that kind of thing, because I don't want that to happen. But I think everybody, is trying to get a leg up, and people are trying it. Whether or not it's going to work, I don't know.
Yeah, I think it's similar to when I was, because I'm old, when I was younger, right, everyone read maps. And now you have the GPS on your phone. No one knows how to read a map anymore. It's insane. They can have the GPS up on your Uber, and the guy can't read the map to show him where he's going, even though there's a little dot on it. I think the same thing can happen very easily with your writing ability.
Yeah, people are going to forget how to write a term paper. They're going to forget how to do this, forget how to do that, because we just don't have to do it anymore. And some of those things should go by the wayside. We shouldn't have to waste time doing certain things if we can get a computer to do it for us. But something like writing for me, I've always enjoyed doing it, whether people were paying me for it or not. It's something I sit down and I do every day because I like to do it. So I'm not going to get a machine to do it for me.
Is there, when you, and we're wrapping up in just a second here, just when you do so many interviews, so much media, is there ever a question that nobody asks you that you wish they would? Is there ever something you want to say that you never get a chance to insert into these conversations?
There probably is, but if you put me on the spot right now, it's not going to come to me. I will think about it, and I'll probably get the perfect answer 5 minutes after we hang up.
Well, fantastic. Next time we talk, we can do that. So one final question. This is the only thing I ask all the authors, and it sounds really simple, but it's where do you think story comes from? And I've heard some really bizarre answers to this, you know, like in my opinion, like the all, you know, it's like the multiverse, right? Like every configuration, every possibility does exist, and you're pulling the pieces together in this unique story. Where does story come from? Where do these amazing, unique stories you come up with come from?
Yeah, I really don't know, and I've asked that question of myself a bunch of times. I mean, because when I'm sitting there writing and everything is firing on all cylinders, it's like watching a movie play out in my head, and I'm writing it down as fast as I can, and I don't know where it's coming from. And there have been plenty of times where I've written a scene where I have stopped and pushed the computer across my desk and like, holy shit, I can't believe that just came out of my head. You know, it's either because it's scary or it's good or it's this or it's that, but like, I don't know where it came from. And, you know, I don't know. I mean, it's like the day we all learn that, I think it might be like a very enlightening day. But I'm glad it's there. You know, it's the same thing with music. You know, people who can write songs, people who can paint. I don't know where it comes from, but I'm glad it's there.
Well, it's a little bit of magic, and I'm glad you're sharing it with us. So thank you so much for this. This has been really terrific. Where do you want our readers to go to find your work?
Easiest place to find me is at jdbarker.com. The books themselves are in every bookstore. Next one coming out is The First Scarlet Door, releases in September.
Well, fantastic. You're always welcome to Elaine's Literary Salon, and good luck with the upcoming book, and we hope to have you on again soon.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.